Yay, I'm recording.
Testing. Well, this is the first time we've talked about this film. We weren't just talking for the last 15 minutes about it or anything.
Absolutely not. Getting fresh new insight into this movie that's been out for 42 years because it came out the year that I was born. We're talking about Suspiria by Dario Argento. I think one of the most famous horror movies from the 70s, probably one of the most celebrated horror movies from the era for sure. And I think it was your first time seeing it.
Yeah. And I've never seen anything. I've seen like very few, especially older Italian films, and I've never seen a Dario Argento film.
We should probably do the entire trilogy at this point. I was just thinking about that. It gets progressively worse. So then we get to the third movie, we're going to be like, maybe not. But
does it keep the visual language, though, and style? Like,
no.
Really?
No. The second movie does a little bit. The third movie was made after... like 27 years, I think.
Oh, okay.
Something like that. Don't quote me on it. In enough time to put his adult daughter in it, who's a terrible actress.
Is she the lead?
She's the lead, and she's actually a very famous actress in Italy.
And is still terrible to this day?
It's not good. It is not good. There's really no way to spin it in terms of, like, does it even need to exist? Probably not. Because, I mean, I don't think Suspiria in and of itself is a good movie. What makes it good is sort of, like, the visual structure, the production sort of, like, aspect of it. But then Inferno is kind of, like, it's fun. It's an entertaining, fun movie with interesting, like, set pieces for the various deaths that happen in it. And then Mother of Tears is just
got a bad show.
I don't even know why he felt like he needed to make it. Other than probably he was given enough money to be like, sure, let's give it a shot.
Kind of a George Lucas situation.
It's hard to say because he's really sort of lost even that kind of eye for storytelling that he definitely had back in the day. The sort of like storytelling aspect was always kind of like a struggle, but then he made up for that with really beautiful production. And it was actually one of my birthday parties that I kept his Dracula in the background, and we were sort of like all noticing how drab it looked, just in terms of really empty looking sets, like. It looked like a struggle from a production like standpoint in terms of like we didn't have enough money to furnish the set, and it's just so very very bizarre. Just kind of like track this kind of devolution, but in many ways I think Suspiria is the apex of his sort of output. It's one of his first films and probably the most representative in terms of like what his filmic language is like, or used to be like.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because it's definitely the visual language in this film that's just stands out as the most amazing thing. I love, for example, how, you know, this is kind of a classic thing in horror movies that we see all the time now, but that right from the top, he uses these shots of seemingly like things that would be innocuous if they weren't set to like scary music or like over the top sound effects. So, for example, like right as what is her name, Susie, is getting off the airplane in the first scene, we cut to the automatic door. Like, well, first of all, like the second she looks out the front door as she's walking down the hall, like it's like the music changes and the wind starts blowing outside, and you immediately know something's off. But I thought what was really interesting that immediately as she's walking through the door, it actually cuts to. The mechanism of the door that sort of looks like it's like almost like it's stabbing into itself. You know, obviously there's the sort of like the over the top, like something's wrong. It's fucking pouring rain, But, you know, he also does this close up of like a storm drain just like emptying, and he layers that with like basically the sound of that is like so like it's like a complete din. And it's like if you just film this in a rainstorm normally, that's not scary at all. But because of the way that he does it, kind of like piggybacking off that, like the most impressive thing and the most like artful thing for me is close-ups in this movie, whether it's characters or objects. I find the object close-ups really interesting. Like I think my two favorite shots in the movie were, well, I have three favorite shots in the movie. The two close-ups though are the wine glass when she's yes. chugging the wine, and you actually don't see her, you just see the wine glass taking up half the lens basically. And then also the light bulb.
Yeah. That scene especially reminded me of the milk scene in Suspicion with Cary Grant going up the stairs. And because Hitchcock wanted the focal point of that sequence to be the glass of milk, he put a light bulb in it and light it up. So it's basically this glass of milk coming up the stairs with a light bulb inside. And it looks so striking and obviously sort of like calling for your attention, like you know that it might be poison. There might be something wrong with this glass of milk. Yeah, I think the DP, the director of photography in this film is probably the real unsung hero more than probably Argento is. It is, I think, one of the very last movies to be shot in Technicolor.
Oh, yeah. I saw that in the credits. Yeah.
Because I taught it once, and I think that the story goes that they were able to find the last Technicolor machine available in Cinecittà, I think, or wherever they were shooting. And then basically took it and ran away with it. And they shot the movie using Technicolor and I think also CinemaScope. So it was basically a very expensive movie to shoot. That's what it comes down to. But especially the CinemaScope and the work, the director of photography is Luciano Tovoli, that he did with anamorphic lenses and the arc lamps. Basically every scene that's saturated with color, really, really amazing, because they were able to sort of achieve that kind of like lens saturation with the use of fabric instead of gel.
Okay, explain that a little bit more. What does lens saturation mean?
When you basically see all the close-ups and extreme close-ups that you were talking about, and it looks like the faces of the actors or just the set is almost like painted.
Okay.
The colors are so rich.
Like that hallway that they keep coming back to, for example.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Especially like the deep sort of like purple tones in the film. Those were literally pieces of fabric held in front of the lamps.
That's cool.
The arc lamps I don't think are used anymore, but basically it's probably one of the brightest lamps ever used to make film. Really, really sort of like white, strong light that kind of like imbued the shot with whatever color filter you put in front of it. And also, I guess, the CinemaScope, which kind of like amplifies your peripheral view in a way, so that you get a lot more depth of field in the shot, which is kind of like also kind of like a technique that's gotten like lost. As I said, some of these techniques were kind of like popular in the 50s and the 60s, and then by the time the 70s rolled around, it had just become too expensive to keep like making movies like this
because of the fact that it was older technology and there were less experts still around to work it and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, just because it was just really, really expensive machinery to purchase. I guess the kind of like historical relevance of this film also rests on the idea that it's one of the very last films to use the anamorphic lenses and CinemaScope and Technicolor, which is basically how Gone with the Wind was shot.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really at the end of the kind of era of filmmaking. So I don't really think you can even like achieve the same kind of richness of color anymore without probably resorting to CGI nowadays. Right. And I think most of the credit for the movie, for what the movie is, really goes to this sort of like visual approach that the director of photography was able to achieve. I think when people talk about Suspiria, they think about more than the story, they think about the way the movie looks.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of, just a quick side note, speaking of like technology in terms of achieving a certain shot, I've always wondered, how do they do pouring rain shots in movies, especially like when they're moving around in a car? How is that achieved?
Generally, I think the car just kind of like moves around in a loop, and it's in a contained space, or just kind of moves around in a very contained space where artificial rain is being poured on. Part of what I think makes it work is also that when she's in the car, you basically mainly see lights outside. You don't really see like concrete spaces or buildings. Mm. And a lot of that is just projecting lights against the window and then the water against it to sort of like mimic the pouring rain.
Gotcha.
Yeah. A lot of rain nowadays is done like with CGI effects.
Right. One reason that I'm really happy that I met Nancy, my girlfriend of a year, is that she fucking hates digital effects and points them out whenever they're terrible. So just in watching a movie like this, like even if the practical effects had, like even if the effect of that is something looking campy and ridiculous, it is so much more satisfying to see that. And there's, it just feels like there's so much more care taken to the visual effects. In the era of practical effects.
I'm really of two minds in terms of like, there's a lot that can be done in terms of CGI to enhance space and kind of like architecture and the negative sort of like space surrounding the characters. But when it comes to actually applying CGI to people, it almost never works for me. So yeah. it's something that works around the characters. It's something that works in establishing shots. It's something that doesn't quite work for me when you start layering on top of faces.
Right.
The one of the things that that took me out in terms of like watching The Irishman, for example, was how they try to sort of like use CGI to make the characters, the actors, look younger.
Oh, yeah.
In the parts of the movie that were supposed to take place in flashbacks or in the past. With the effect of sort of like the characters or the faces looking like a mix of like a real person and some kind of CGI created or generated monster.
Yeah. They look like yeah. these ghastly apparitions kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just watching, a friend of mine, made me rewatch all of the Twilight movies. hi Luke, a couple of nights ago. And, by the time I was watching the fifth movie, the two characters have a baby and the baby for no clear reason is entirely CGI. And it is the creepiest thing. And even worse, at the beginning, of the shooting, they were going to go with some kind of animatronic creature that was even creepier.
Wait,
I have to link you to
that. I gotta ask you, so which was worse? I don't think you saw this movie, but did you know that in American Sniper they use like a baby doll instead of a real baby for one of the scenes?
I did not watch
that movie. I know you didn't watch
it. I'm not surprised.
So what would you prefer? Would you prefer creepy CGI baby or clearly a doll that's used in place of a real baby?
I guess neither.
No, you have to choose. That's the game.
Probably the CGI.
I go with the doll.
It really depends because they're both going to take me out, but there's a way to work on CGI to make it look like a decent approximation of reality, whereas with the doll, you're stuck with the doll.
Right.
To give you another example, I rewatched Misery last week, and the fight at the end of the movie, the climax between the two characters, when Annie Wilkes falls and she hits her head on the typewriter, it's clearly a doll, and it lands and sort of like falls with the way that a doll works. And you see the doll's face, and it doesn't even look like Kathy Bates. It always, even in 1990, when the movie came out, it struck me as such an odd thing to put in a close-up.
Well, I think the key thing for both of them is, like, does this bad CGI or bad practical effect track with like the level of effects in the movie in general, right?
Right.
Because I can accept, oh, this is like from the top, this is a low budget film, or like from the top, like, oh, these practical effects are super campy and obviously not realistic. But it's like when something doesn't like fall in line with what you've seen previously in the film, that you're just like, fuck this.
Exactly. It essentially, any time you're able to sort of like single it out, it means that it didn't blend. And if it doesn't blend into the rest of the mise-en-scène or whatever it is, it's never going to look right.
Right.
It's always going to take you out a little bit. And I guess like the end goal of good CGI is not to be noticeable.
Right.
Right. And they're able to do that with a lot of sort of like with art direction and just in terms of like recreating spaces that would not be possible just by just building sets and stuff like that. When you watch like sci-fi movies with really sort of like sprawling landscapes, all of that is CGI, and you obviously don't notice it because it's inanimate objects. But when it comes to animals, anything that's like an animated object, unless it's done really, really well and like in a really subtle way, it is going to jump out. And so there's basically this monster baby at the end of Twilight that's being like pestered around like parents and extended family, and there's also like no clear reason why this baby would have to be CGI'd. And the face is, first of all, it looks like a CGI idea of a baby, but the face is also like offset in terms of like where the rest of the body is. It's just really done really poorly. So you're like, what is going on? What is this? And I tweeted about it like a couple of days ago, and people were like, oh my God, what is this? And then they linked me to the original footage that never made it into the movie, where they actually thought at the beginning they were going to go with some kind of animatronic kind of like robot monster baby. It is just the worst thing. And the face of that, the face of that robot is not my reaction shot for everything that happens on Twitter. It's really just the best.
You gotta send me that GIF.
Oh, let me see if I can like pull it up.
Oh my God. You know what it's like? Oh fuck. You know what it's like is, what's that really famous painting? It's not by El Greco, but it's by one of the, one of the Spanish masters, and then Foucault has like this big like commentary on it. It's the royal court with like a bunch of like children as well, and then there's a big mirror in it. But the big eyes of that, and sort of like the kind of doll like features really remind me of that. It's like Las Meninas de something. We had to read Foucault's like fucking meta ass commentary in that in this art class that I took as a gen ed in college, and we were like,
that's so cool.
We were all like 20, and we're like, I don't fucking know what he's talking about. Like, this is, it was literally unreadable for me.
Foucault is really good to read when you're inebriated or high.
Right.
In relation to the movie, the scenes that would probably require CGI nowadays are actually mostly achieved with the use of like really extreme close-ups. It's just, it's something that you don't really see that much anymore. Especially death scenes in horror movies play out on medium or long shots nowadays to really get a sense of like totality in the shot. Whereas in movies like this, it's really on the face of the victim,
which to me is very compelling, actually.
Yeah. There are some pretty deranged close-ups in this movie.
Oh my God, the close-up of so. When the first murder victim dies and the lady that she's staying with, and the ceiling, like the body of the first lady comes down through the ceiling, and then the second lady gets impaled by the ceiling and like the wrought iron that came down that was supporting it.
Oh,
so fucking cool.
Yeah. That is also, I think, one of the most beautifully lit scenes in the movie, especially. I have the Blu-ray of the restoration that was done like a few years ago. It is so bright and crisp and so striking. You find yourself like fascinated with the gore in a way, because it is so appealing and so beautiful, which kind of, like, I think creates this kind of dissonance between the fact that you should feel bad or horrified, but then at the same time, you're attracted, aesthetically attracted to the violence and the blood and this dismembering of the bodies.
Yeah, it's sort of like a more artistic version of what camp is, right? Like in camp, there's a craft to the absurdity, and here there's such a craft to the violence. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Mm-hmm.
It's, I think, really his signature in his most sort of like famous movies. I'm also thinking of Inferno, for example. Like he really comes to play when it's about killing characters in spectacular ways. I feel as though his movies are kind of like responsible for how sort of like death is fetishized in contemporary horror film, especially in movies like the Saw movies, for example, where each death is kind of like a set piece, mm-hmm. that kind of like exists untethered from the rest of the movie in a way. Yeah, he kind of invented that in a way, and I remember when I was a kid, because I was a kid when these movies were being sort of like released in theaters. This movie came out when I was the year that I was born, and then Inferno came out, I think, in 1980. So I remember classmates talking about his movies already in elementary, when I was in elementary school, and obviously they're not okay movies for kids to watch, no. But you know how kids are. So yeah, I remember really the conversation being like, what is the goriest, most spectacular sort of like death in an Argento movie that you can think of, and why is it so deranged, and what did it make you feel like, were you scared, and blah 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 blah. The way that violence is sort of like fetishized and portrayed, it there's kind of like an ode to death in a way, right. That's almost poetic, I would say, for how horrible it is, and for how much these characters, usually women, for how much they end up suffering. There's like an aesthetics of death that exists in these movies, but we've kind of stepped away from that a little bit. I can't really think of any sort of contemporary movies where so much aesthetic sort of like attention is put into creating visually appealing death scenes. Mm-hmm. It's more in terms of like going for gore and going for grossing out the audience. Maybe Martyrs kind of does that a little bit. It's a French movie that came out a few years ago, but not with the same level of sort of like abandon that Argento has. He just really likes to torture women in very spectacular, beautiful ways.
So there is kind of a slasher dynamic, or a full slasher dynamic, going on in this film, right? About like punishing women for not being virgins.
I think in this specific movie, the main sort of like concern is to establish the mythology of the three witches for the trilogy. So it's in a way, I think, about punishing women that do not conform.
Right.
And also like preserving kind of like this century old coven that is really concealed in the academy, this ballet academy, dance academy, whatever it is. That's sort of like the facade for this coven. It's really, I think, about punishing women that don't conform to the rules. Strictly speaking, the rules of the Dance Academy, punishing women that interrogate the status quo.
Right, like Susie is always asking questions about what's going on. Sarah is trying to invest, like, she was taking notes about the stuff that was happening and they got stolen. And then it seemed like the first character who got killed, who we see running through the forest at the very beginning,
she had found out about the common, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you know what? The reason I was thinking about the virgin slasher thing is that I initially, before we knew what she was saying, when she said, like, flower hidden or something like that, was one of the girls had said something about, like, her having a relationship with, like, the male ballet dancer. So I was like, oh, it's a slasher. She's getting punished for being a quote unquote slut.
I think the concern with sort of like promiscuity is more a driving force in American horror film than it is in European horror film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. For at the very least, for as far as this movie is concerned, it's really about punishing women that speak out against the status quo. In this case, though, I think it's interesting that the status quo is being forced by other women rather right. than sort of like the patriarchal structure that you would imagine like a woman rebelling against that's been enforced by men. It is I think about women who refuse to conform.
Right,
and I don't think that theme specifically carries out or is really explored in the trilogy that much. I would have even a harder time sort of like deciding what Inferno is about, other than the fact that there's a bunch of really beautiful sort of like set pieces in it where characters get killed off. I would have to revisit it. It's been a while, but in a way it is even more kind of like discombobulated and dreamlike than Suspiria is, to the point that some sequences don't really make sense within the larger sort of like logical architecture of the story. So it's almost as though death sort of like takes place in kind of like a dreamlike space in a way, or a space that doesn't quite make sense with the sort of like fabric of reality that the rest of the movie is. Yeah.
Yes, I would totally agree with that. And I was going to say something about like, there's so much is done with so little in terms of what actually happens on screen in this film, especially in the death sequences. So take, for example, the blind piano player. Basically, yeah. all that is, right, is just like switching between like kind of an upward, like full body shot of him and the dog. And like this extreme long shot of like him in the center of the square, right? And then there's some panning, which indicates like him looking around. But nothing is happening there, right? We don't actually see anything. But because of how crafty the camera work is, and also we haven't even mentioned the score yet. The score in this film is amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
And then the score... and the sound effects on top of that, how those three things are layered, it feels scary. And it feels like it's like this isolated, like, in that way, it does feel very dreamlike to me.
What makes that death scene work is that there's no in between, sort of like between the really sort of like long shots that frame the entire square from kind of like this bird's eye view. In terms of the camera, and then the close-up shots of literally the dog eating the piano player.
I love that.
There's no in between. So it's really the entirety of like this space that's very empty, so that it enhances kind of like the helplessness of a character that's already physically impaired.
Right.
And then move from there to extreme close-ups of him being attacked and killed by the dog. No in between, no middle shots, nothing to sort of like carry from one shot to the other, sort of like to break that kind of like, or to help the kind of flow, that visual flow. So it's just very disorienting in a way. It just makes you kind of like... It makes you wonder how much of this is happening and how much of this is real. I think it's putting stress on the importance of sound over sight because of how vast and empty that square is, and how sort of like if you in the shoes of the character, how you would have to rely on sound to protect yourself. And to understand what is happening. And then also the fact that literally your companion, the figure that you rely on to in your everyday life, which is your seeing eye dog, rebels against you. So you also lose that connection to reality in a way, to experiencing everyday reality around you. It is really scary. And I think there's definitely a stress put on how much sound gets dispersed in really large empty spaces in ways that lose the character completely.
I just thought of a parallel actually for his dog, like his closest companion betraying him. There's actually a direct parallel in Sarah coming back from the dead and then trying to kill Susie at the end of the film.
I know.
Like Sarah is kind of the one that's like trying to lead Susie through to find the truth, I guess. Kind of holding her hand throughout. And zombie Sarah is my favorite. She's great.
She's the one that helps Susie figure out how to get into sort of like the bowels of the academy. And it's also done, everything regarding that is actuated through sound instead of sight, because they are counting the steps that they hear when they're pretending to sleep. And in a way, yeah, the movie relies a lot on sound to either lose the characters or clue the characters into what's happening, as opposed to seeing things. Even the fact that Imelda Marcos at the end, the witch, is invisible, right? So what gives off her presence is her voice. And then when I think there's like lightning outside, and for a second, you're able to kind of like make out the contour of her silhouette, and that's what, yeah. But there's very little trusted on characters seeing as opposed to characters hearing in this film.
Right.
Which I think works, because generally I think we tend to experience horror more visually than we do with our ears.
Right.
So it's sort of like, it's as an audience, it's sort of like training us to rely on a different sense that we're not really used to activate when we experience watching film, as a spectator. So in a way, it's a challenge, but it also calls on you to feel a little lost to yourself.
Yeah. Like as a kind of a consumer of more modern horror, like the first murder scene where the lady is looking out the window for like freaking ever, that felt so long. It's all about her like experiencing this like unsurety of like what she's seeing, right? But as an audience, we're seeing nothing, right? We're just seeing the expression on her face and her reflection in the window.
Right. And the same thing happens with the first dancer that gets killed when she's leaving the academy in a hurry at night. We don't get to hear what she says, but we know that it's important, and we know that it holds kind of like the key to solving what's actually going on in this academy. But it's drowned out by the sound of the storm and the rain. So really, sound in this film kind of like carries meaning and also carries sort of like diegetic purpose.
Meaning narrative.
Yeah. In terms of like absconding like clues or revealing clues that help sort of like crack the story open.
Right. There is a little bit of using visual clues to indicate what's going to happen in the future, though, as foreboding, though. Like, for example, or before the character mentions that she's been like tracking their steps, there are a few foot tracking shots, especially it starts in the larva scene where package of food goes bad and there's larvae everywhere in the attic. Another kind of interesting foreboding one that I don't quite understand this motif, actually, is the time motif. It was funny. I didn't notice this at the beginning, but it totally, like, feeds in with it. When the vice principal is talking to Susie for the first time, and then she's like, oh, I gotta go. She says, à tout à l'heure, for apparently no reason. Like, it's like, why did you say that? Like, you're not French.
That's so funny. I think my mom used to say that.
Really?
And I think it's kind of like a upper middle class way to sort of like portray status.
So even if you're Italian?
A tutelare. Yeah. Huh. Which it's a French greeting, essentially.
Or it's basically see you later.
See you later, yeah.
Literally, l'heure is the hour, right? So we're talking about time.
Yeah. it is, I think it's very much a signifier of sort of like class or a performance of class.
Okay. Let me give you my other two like foreboding time related stuff. And then I want to just get into the time motif because I don't really get it and I haven't thought about it too much. So obviously the watch letter, which keeps, you know, telling us the building's going to burn down at the end. But someone also says just like clockwork during the film. So what is, what does that all mean? What is this time motif? Is it that like we're in like this dream state and time doesn't really apply, or
it doesn't because you would be hard pressed to sort of like decode how much time passes in between the opening and closing events of the film. But then by the same token, time does matter because it is exactly time that has made this coven so strong. And the fact that the head witch is centuries old is really the key to her status in the hierarchy of the coven. Yeah, she's the oldest witch.
The Black Queen, as we find out.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that for all these kind of like references to the passing of time in the film, there's, I think, very little sense of time passing. There's also no interest in tracking time in the film for any chronological purposes. Horror movies that do that usually put the date or the time on the screen to clue you in as the time is passing. In Ring, it happens a lot, for example, because the curse that you're kind of like stuck with exhausts itself over the course of 7 days. So there's kind of like this idea of time running out. Here, it could be a case that like this movie takes place over the period of like a week or 4 months. Right. I don't know that it's like really indicated that we should even care. In a way, and the Academy itself is kind of like a place where time is suspended. I don't know why, but like every time there's action happening in the Academy, to me it always feels as though it's happening at night, even when they're rehearsing ballet.
Right.
I don't know if it's because of the lighting or what, but there's just a sense of something being slightly off.
Yeah, it's kind of like being inside the Academy is like being inside a casino. Yeah. Right? Like it feels like there's no natural light at all.
Yeah, there's no natural light at all. So the sense that I distinctly remember thinking, why are they rehearsing at night? The first time that I watched the movie, in the scene that Susie ends up passing out.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's starting to like experience sort of like what's happening in the Academy. And I think they're kind of like playing with her food and putting stuff in her food. I distinctly remember thinking, why are they rehearsing at night? And then at the end of the movie, I was like, well, I guess maybe they weren't, but there's really no indication as to when they were, but just the lighting doesn't really concern itself with marking days over nights or vice versa.
Right.
It's really interesting. And I think it works in terms of like creating the sense of like anxiety. I feel as though movies especially that take away a sense of time passing from the audience create a sense of kind of like additional anxiety, because time and space are two markers of reality for us as people that we use to sort of like measure life.
Right.
So when that is taken away from us, it's kind of like being cut at the knees as a person, not knowing, am I supposed to sleep? Am I supposed to be awake? Where am I? When am I? So, yeah.
Did you write about this in one of your books?
I did, I think. Not specifically about Suspiria, though. I talked about how space is coded in horror film culture, but not really in these terms. It was more in terms of like mise-en-scène, when space is subtracted by the frame itself.
Okay, explain that, because that's the second time you've mentioned negative space in a shot. I don't understand what that is.
Well, negative space in and of itself is empty space in the shot that's not being used.
Okay.
Which in horror film can be played with in so many different ways, but also like what horror film does really well is play with the sort of like suggested space that exists beyond the frame that you sense is there, but you don't see. There's a sense of, I think, anxiety that audiences experience, especially when they watch horror film, in terms of like what lies just outside of the frame and what could enter the frame at any given time or moment. Negative space in general, you can talk about negative space in this film when the death sequence of the piano player, for example, and all the negative space around him in the square,
right,
and how that's used to sort of like disperse and negate sound. But then, like, there's also this idea of suggested space around the frame, because obviously we're trained to think as film viewers that everything that's in frame is what we need to pay attention to, and everything that's outside of the frame doesn't exist because we're not asked to care.
Right.
But then in horror film, that changes a bit because of this uncertainty / anxiety about what lies just outside the frame and what could enter the frame at any given moment.
Right. For example, like when there's a long dark hallway that goes until like a vanishing point, but you know, like that the hallway is longer and like what the fuck is at the end of this hallway, right?
Yeah. I mean, right. One of the examples that when I teach this, one of the examples that I use and I show my students is the scene with the killer nun in The Exorcist 3, which is one of the most startling uses of, I guess, non-diegetic space, whatever you want to call it, suggested space of something that abruptly enters the frame and just shocks you because it is so unexpected and so contrary to what you are, to what you're taught as a film viewer to expect when watching a film.
Right.
You're not really taught to pay attention to what could lay outside of the frame, because if it's not there, it doesn't matter. Except in horror film, it does. There's a sense of like additional danger in a way of what could just lay outside of the frame, and you and the character on screen are not privy to that.
Right.
I think when we talked about the scene of the death of the piano player, that's, I think, a really good use of negative space, because it really enhances this sense of loneliness and isolation for the character who's already visually impaired, which enhances this idea of this person really being lost in an empty space.
Right. Do you want to go to random odds and ends that we like to do at the end of the pod?
Do you want to talk about the score at all? Because the score is iconic.
Yeah, for sure. But I like don't have any specific notes about it. Like, I thought that it feels like there's some sort of early electronica in there a little bit. Let me throw in one score related. So obviously, like, there's the main theme that involves the, I don't know what it's called. I think it's a xylophone, right? It's like a xylophone, but it has like metal plates instead of like the wooden ones, right? And then it has like a plastic mallet, sort of.
I don't know what it's called. I don't know that, but I know what it looks like. Yeah.
Right. So that main theme, and this is actually one of my odds and ends, I need to know, is that when in Cabin in the Woods or in the basement and one of them grabs the ballerina and then turns the kind of like dancer music box? Is that the theme that's playing?
No, it's not, but it's very similar.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would have been fun.
It's very, very similar. I think the score, first of all, is just unhinged.
Yeah.
There's no logical reason why a movie like this should have this kind of like electronic 70s kind of like electronica score. It's made by Goblin. That's the name of the band. And I think the most hysterical thing is not only does the theme really sort of like clash with the images so much, but the fact that the only lyrics in the theme, the main theme, are witches. Which
that's what it's saying. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So you have this theme that just basically vomits this word like over and over again. Witches, and you're like, isn't that kind of a spoiler? It just really unhinged. And Goblin made so much money out of this movie, rightfully so, because it's really an amazing they did amazing work, and they still tour to this day, taking the music of from this film and other films that they've done around, even in the U.S.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I think the score too, like we were talking earlier about the ability of this film, like to just it shoots stuff in a really creative way, but there's really not that much happening on screen
right.
in general.
Right.
But yeah, what keeps the tension going and just like keeps you interested, a big part of that, besides the visual style, is also the score. The combo of the visual style and the score is like fucking awesome.
And I can't really think of any other horror movie that relies so much on sort of like electronic progressive kind of rock score
mm-hmm.
to, it's almost kind of like a character in the movie. It is such a presence for a movie that relies so much on sound. It really is almost like a character unto itself. I love the score and I love how unhinged and kind of like nonsensical it is.
Yeah.
Which is. Yeah. Odds and ends?
Odds and ends. Well, yes. The Cabin in the Woods one was one. Another one is, a quick one. Jessica Harper looks and sounds so much like Karen Allen. It's like kind of creepy.
Really
Yeah. Especially the voice.
Yes.
Like, for those who don't know, Karen Allen plays Miriam in Raiders of the Lost Ark, among
mm-hmm.
other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what was the other one? Oh, I was wondering, so there's this random character at the beginning that you think is going to be in the fucking movie, but isn't. Very Italian-looking, black-haired lady who's kind of the gossip queen. And Jessica Harper character, Susie, stays with her like at the beginning of the film, right? And then that gossip queen kicks her out. Do you think that Mila Kunis's character in Black Swan is influenced by that character?
Physically or
in terms of like her behavior, sort of like the badassery and also sort of like the behind the scenes, like kind of like machinations.
I think the purpose of the character is like in a way twofold. It's she's kind of like a harbinger in a way, the kind of like trope of the harbinger in horror film, but also she's supposed to make Susie feel like she's the odd man out at the academy. Like she doesn't quite. Like, she doesn't quite belong right from the get-go. There's this kind of, like, tension, like, that makes it obvious for Susie, but also for us as the audience, that she doesn't quite belong into the academy, and that she's probably not going to blend in as well as she would want to for a number of different reasons. This character, her room, the most incredible wallpaper I've ever seen in my life.
Oh yeah, with like it's like
the black and white wallpaper. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And why would a dance academy have rooms that look like that?
Oh, it's no, just, she has her own apartment.
Oh, that's in her own apartment.
Yeah.
Okay. The space of the dance academy, I always think of like what kind of dance academy would have so many random mirrors and like walls that are like of such a deep hue of purple. The surroundings themselves really enhance like a sense of like anxiety to me.
Yeah. The red walls in the hallway. Why do you think there's so many shots of that hallway?
Because hallways are scary.
Okay, that and then also like a lot of the time the camera is moving down the hallway. So it's like telling you in advance, like they're going to do the footsteps thing because they're always listening to footsteps in the hallway. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. The footsteps and also the breathing of the witches when they're asleep, those are like the two main sort of clues as to there's more happening in this academy than what the eye suggests.
Right.
Yeah.
The bat is fucking amazing. It's like a gigantic vampire bat with a full set of human teeth. And just like the scrunched up, like evil, angry look on its face is so great. And it's like it's so clearly on a string and not flying. Like it just kind of hovers in the air. And like when she smashes it, it's just fucking great.
It's a bat that took a hammer to the face.
Yep.
That's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's so many little weird details in this film. Also, like the invasion of like maggots from the attic. So many little cues that really like tell you what the fuck is going on.
The dog eating its master.
Yeah,
that's so good.
Yeah,
I got two other things. One, the reflection shot of like you know how she meets like those two professors of psychiatry. Where somehow, I don't know how the fuck they did this, but like when she's talking to the second one, who's like the expert in the occult, like they're shooting them sitting on like the concrete bench, and then there's a there's a skyscraper that has a bunch of glass on it behind them, and then like initially the camera is just like in front of them, and then it starts zooming in on them, and then it zooms past them, and then you're watching a shot of their reflection in the glass.
Yes, that was fucking so cool. And in general, there's a lot of skill involved. When we talked about like the framing and the photography in the film, there's a lot of skill involved in making this film look as striking as it does. A lot of little details.
Definitely. Yeah. Let me give you another one though too. The overhead shot of Sarah and Susie swimming, treading water in the pool, where it's like way overhead, it makes it look like they had these enormous arms and legs, and that their heads are completely disembodied from the moving arms. That's so fucking cool.
Yes.
It's awesome.
Yes. Many of these details are supposed to sort of like almost like dehumanize the characters in a way. Right. It's almost like the space itself kind of like dehumanizes the bodies. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then my very last thing that I think I also didn't mention on this take is I wouldn't be surprised if the X-Files was influenced by this, especially from a lighting perspective. Like the X-Files, literally anytime anything is off, like where they're in a room and there's some mysterious presence in the room and it's dark, there's always just a shit ton of red light, like almost like pastel red light reflected on the walls and off of everything. And that this film just does that in spades.
Yeah. And because it's not natural lighting, it tells you something is afoot. Yeah.
Right.
A lot of it is just also supposed to sort of like externalize the character's emotions. It's like a psychological use of lighting almost to kind of like enhance what the character is thinking or feeling or experiencing. Yeah.
Well, it's something they did with that sort of like, I'm calling it pastel lighting, but that's not correct. But just like these really solid colors that are everywhere in the frame.
Saturated. Yeah.
Saturated. Yeah. They kept doing this thing where they would have a shot of the character in sort of like quote unquote normal light, and then we cut away for a second, and like nothing's happening at that point. And then we cut away for a second to something else, and then we cut back, and we're just flooded with the saturated light. Like an example of that is in the scene where Susie and Sarah are in the bedroom right before Sarah dies. And it's just like, yeah, 1 second we're just looking at her normally, and then cut away for 1 sec, and then everything is flooded in green light. And then we do this whole scene in green light for a long time.
Yes.
Okay, one last thing.
Yes.
So I think that there is a small meta commentary of self-awareness. I mean, this film is very self-aware in general, but like an explicit, like a moment where it's trying to tell you that, which is when Sarah is fleeing the person with the straight razor and she goes into the store and she latches it. And then the person with the straight razor is like using the, trying to use it to unlatch it from behind the door.
Yeah.
Like throughout that sequence where she's fleeing. And then when she's in the room for about maybe like a minute or so, like, you know, you have the crazy soundtrack, like going everywhere, electro, like, and these like really like just like frantic sound effects, everything. And then it just stops. And suddenly the scene is not scary at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's a moment of pause, yeah.
Right,
yeah,
and it almost felt like, yeah, this is what we're doing. Like, what's happening on screen is not that important. It's the way that we're framing it to you.
Yes, yes. Something very mundane is made terrifying by the visual and auditory kind of layers on that are put on top of it. Yeah, yeah. This movie does that really, really well. And I think it really it's always a movie that I recommend people should watch. Just because it is so unusual. I can guarantee you, if you haven't seen this movie, you've never seen anything quite like it.
No, definitely not.
And I mean really seen.
Right.
Yeah. From a visual perspective, you've never seen anything that quite looks like this movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, at the end of the day, it's a movie that I really like recommending to people because it's kind of like an experience.
Oh, it certainly is.
And I don't think the remake really needs to, or there's really no visual or really any justification for the remake to exist as something that's like tacked on the original movie.
It was just made because of the like the director's nostalgia for Suspiria.
There's really no impetus to kind of like reinvent or pay tribute, or it's just, yeah, it's just kind of really flat and long and kind of a slog. Yeah.
All right. That's all the odds and all the ends that I got.
Yay. We talked about this for way longer than I thought we were going to talk about it.
It always happens.
It does.
All right.
But we should, I don't know what we should do next, but if you can find it, I would love for you to watch The House with Laughing Windows.
Is that another horror? Is that another horror film?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we should turn this into a horror podcast.
No, haven't we already?
basically, yeah.
It's probably one of my favorite films. So yeah.
What is it called?
House with Laughing Windows.
Laughing Windows?
Laughing Windows.
Laughing Windows.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you still there? You are frozen.
God damn it.
No. I think I'm still recording. I am still recording, yeah. I am going to text you because you're completely frozen. Frozen.
This is fun. My internet.
You
ain't shit.
Froze. Yay!
Yay! And we're back. So you were talking about the...
I love you.